Welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Barbara, and with me in the studio is George.
Hello.
In this month's episode, we have put together a very special one on everything to do with the Simons Observatory. We visited the Simons Observatory conference back in July. This was the very first in-person meeting hosted here in Manchester. And this groundbreaking telescope is located at the Atacama Desert in Chile, and it is an international collaboration that includes 85 institutes from 13 different countries. So this meeting was a great opportunity for cooperation and sharing between astrophysicists, instrumentation engineers, and data scientists.
With Manchester playing a key role within the telescope's development, we talked to SOUK Principal Investigator Professor Michael Brown about what makes this project so exciting. We have also recorded the JODBite with early career researcher Dr. Katie Harrington on her work testing and integrating the instrumentation into large telescope construction.
Finally, we spoke with a range of Simons Observatory collaborators over lunch at the meeting and take a whistle-stop tour on what it really takes and who is involved when you build a telescope.
Phoebe and Jonathan sit down with Professor Michael Brown, who's principal investigator for the Simons Observatory in the UK. He summarizes what makes the Simons Observatory unique and exciting, and the range of astrophysics we can conduct with such an instrument.
So, in the office today, I'm joined by Jonathan Wong and Professor Michael Brown, who's a Professor of Astrophysics here at Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics.
Welcome, Michael. Thanks very much for coming. Could you start by just giving an overview of what the Simons Observatory is, why it's been built, and what its main science goals are?
Sure. Thanks for having us. So Simons Observatory is a next-generation cosmic microwave background experiment. It is an array of several telescopes located in the high Atacama Desert in northern Chile. And its science goals are to really push the frontiers on a number of unknown questions in astrophysics and in fundamental physics. In particular, to understand more the physics that happened in the very early universe. So probing things like how the initial conditions were set in the very early universe, but also to understand how physical effects in more recent evolution of the universe manifest themselves, in particular, trying to understand the nature of unknown substances in the universe, such as dark matter and dark energy, properties in neutrinos, etc. So it does have a very wide range of science goals, in addition to cosmological studies, such as I've just mentioned. It's also going to be a new window on the transient universe. So it will, as one of the telescopes, the large telescope, will survey the sky at very high cadence. So looking repeated observations of the same area of sky frequently, probably daily. And then that will allow us to search for objects that are transient in nature. So they, you know, get brighter and dimmer or go bang, etc. And so this will be the first opportunity in these wave bands to study those objects.
So what are the sort of the newest bits that we couldn't have done before that the Simons Observatory sort of really adds to what we've had previously?
One of the new features of Simons Observatory that is really new for this area of astronomy is the transient nature that I just mentioned. So this will really be the first sort of observatory in the millimeter wavelength where we can do this search for transient events. This is not my particular expertise, so don't probe me too much on this. But that is a new thing that hasn't been done with CMB or cosmic microwave background experiments before. Beyond that, really, it's just a scaling up of the capability of the instruments. So Simons Observatory, if you put all of the telescopes together, will have of order 120,000 detectors deployed on all of its telescopes. And if you think about, for example, the Planck satellite experiment, which is probably the state of the art, that had of order 100 detectors on its telescopes. Of course, Planck was in space, which is a big advantage, whereas Simons Observatory is on the ground. But nevertheless, that huge increase in the numbers of detectors means that we can reach much, much higher sensitivity in our studies. And so the precision with which we can constrain, for example, theories of fundamental physics underlying the early universe is much, much greater given this higher sensitivity that the telescopes are equipped with.
Wow, yeah, that sounds really exciting. So how is it going to impact your work specifically? What are you going to use it for?
So my particular focus is on the search for something called the large scale B-mode polarization signal in the cosmic microwave background. So one of the primary science goals of SIMS Observatory is to search for this, for signatures of primordial gravitational waves that were present in the very, very early universe. So if you think about the Big Bang model of the universe, so it takes initial conditions as an ansatz in that theory that those initial conditions just existed. And then the Big Bang theory effectively works from that starting point. But there's a question about how those initial conditions, those initial very, very small perturbations in the distribution of matter and light and energy, how those initial fluctuations were put in place in the first place. And so one model for how that was imprinted in the early universe is a theory called inflation. There are other models that explain the presence of these initial fluctuations. But either way, if one can detect, so most of the models have some prediction on the level of primordial gravitational waves that would be present at very, very early times. And if one can constrain the level of primordial gravitational waves through observations, then that can allow you to narrow down which of those theories for the generation of those initial conditions is the correct one. And so we do this because, so if primordial gravitational waves, if they were present, should leave a very, very specific signature in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. And so this specific signature, it's a pattern of the polarization vectors on the sky. It's a particular pattern with a certain chirality or directionality associated with it. And that pattern is called B-mode polarization. And so if primordial gravitational waves are not present, then we expect to see zero B-modes on large angular scales. Where if primordial gravitational waves are present, then they should generate this very, very specific B-mode signature. So that hasn't been detected yet, but there is great, great interest in trying to search for that B-mode polarization pattern because of the profound implications it would have for understanding the physics of the early universe.
Wow, yeah, I mean, that's getting pretty early.
It seems like this must be a very, very faint signal then if it requires on the order of 100,000 detectors. So what are the actual difficulties in trying to measure it?
Yeah, it's extremely challenging. So, and as you say, the signal we're looking for is extremely faint. The signal we're looking for might not exist, of course. It might not be present, which is the ultimate faintness you can get, I guess. The challenges on the astrophysics side, it's not just the cosmic microwave background that emits at these frequencies. Our own galaxy emits copious amounts of light and polarized light at these frequencies as well. So in particular, there's huge amounts of synchrotron radiation, which is polarized, which our galaxy emits. And then on the higher frequency side, you get scattering off dust in the galaxy, which emits polarized light at higher frequencies as well. And so one of the things we have to do, one big part of the sort of analysis pipeline for searching for this B-mode signal, is to do something called component separation, which is where you take your observations and you use the multiple different frequency channels that we observe in order to disentangle the different physical components that make up that observed light. So SIMS Observatory observes over a decade in frequency from 27 gigahertz up to 280 gigahertz, and we have 6 frequency channels spread across that range. And the saving grace, the thing that saves us with this, is that the SED, or the spectrum, the frequency spectrum of the synchrotron emission and the frequency spectrum of the dust emission from the galaxy, both of those are from the galaxy, they are different to the spectrum of the CMB. And so by having multiple frequency bands and knowing those different sort of frequency dependencies of the synchrotron emission and the dust emission and the CMB, you can in principle disentangle into the different components. So that's the astrophysical challenge. There are also huge challenges from the instrumental side as well. Just because this signal is so faint, it means that we are susceptible to very minor, very small imperfections in our telescopes. Can actually, for example, you know, if there's an imperfection in some of the optical elements in our telescopes, then that can generate spurious polarization signals just through what we call leakage. And so understanding our instrument really, really, really well is a really key thing. And modeling it, those imperfections through simulations, characterizing the instrument really well through calibration observations, looking at planets, looking at the atmosphere, making sure the calibration between all those 120,000 detectors is as perfect as it can be. There's a huge amount of effort across the entire project and collaboration to try and make the data as perfect as it can be so that we can avoid as best we can interpreting systematic instrumental effects as a B-mode signal.
So you mentioned the Simons Observatory, the collaboration, so all the people behind it. How big is the collaboration and who's working on it and where does that sit?
It's a very large collaboration. It's got, I think, over 400 collaboration members now, ranging from PhD students up to professor level. CMB work has traditionally been the territory of cosmologists, but in more recent years, we have gathered scientists. Scientists are just interested in our observations because it spans such a wide range of frequencies and the sensitivity is so good, and now the resolution as well, that other scientists are very interested in using observations for their science. So I mentioned the transient science. So this is, you know, looking at potentially solar system objects, but also potentially AGN that have variable light curves and understanding the generators of those objects. Scientists that are interested in galaxy evolution. So, for example, study the evolution of galaxies and clusters of galaxies by looking at something called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. This is scattering of CMB photons off hot gas in galaxy clusters and in galaxy halos. And so people interested in galaxy evolution, using those observations to understand galaxy evolution, have come into the collaboration. We've got scientists that are interested in our galaxy. So I mentioned, for example, the synchrotron radiation and the dust emission coming from our galaxy as being a contaminant for the search for B-mode signals. There are, of course, scientists that those signals are the interesting thing, to look at the synchrotron radiation and to look at the dust emission and to try and understand the physics of our galaxy. So galactic astronomers as well. So it really is a whole wide range. There are a lot of cosmologists, but there are increasing numbers of other scientists across the breadth of astrophysics as well.
That's really, really fascinating to hear. So with so many collaborators, I imagine it must be a really international group of people. And, you know, we've been here in Manchester hosting the Simons Observatory face-to-face meeting for the collaboration. So what exactly is kind of the UK's involvement in this? And what is it like working with such an international collaboration of people?
Working with a big international collaboration is challenging and exciting at the same time, I would say. There is a lot of coordination involved and there's a lot of different parts of the collaboration and the project that we have to get our heads around and understand how to work with. In terms of the UK contribution, so we're rather big contributors to this project. Don't think I mentioned, but Simons Observatory is composed of one large aperture telescope, which is a 6-meter reflecting telescope. And it's got 6 small aperture telescopes, which are 0.5-meter diameter refracting telescopes. So the small aperture telescopes are the telescopes that are used for the search for the B-mode polarization signal. And so the UK is actually delivering 2 of those 6 small aperture telescopes. So that's our major sort of telescope hardware contribution. But we're doing more than that. We also host at Manchester here one of the 3 ESO data centers. So as you can imagine, hopefully with 120,000 detectors all reading out at 200 hertz, that's an awful lot of data, and that data needs to be processed and requires a lot of computing power. We have dedicated data centers that deliver that work for us, and one of those is one of the 3 main data centers for ESO is hosted here in Manchester. And then we have postdocs distributed across the UK in the ESO UK based institutes, which are ourselves at Manchester, Oxford, Cambridge, Cardiff, Imperial College London and Sussex Universities. And so we have a team of postdocs distributed over those nodes that are working on developing the pipeline in order to turn that huge amount of data from those 120,000 detectors into what we call science-ready data products that the rest of the collaboration, including ourselves, can then go away and use to exploit in terms of learning new things about the universe.
Brilliant. So thinking what comes next, what are you most excited for to get out of this in sort of the next decade? What's the future for the Simons Observatory?
So maybe I could just mention briefly what we're currently doing. So because we're really certainly in Manchester and Cardiff and Oxford, which are the groups that are working on the instrumentation work for ESO. A big focus right now for us is actually on building these two telescopes. So at Jodrell Bank Observatory, we have one of the telescope receivers, and we are currently integrating the components into that receiver. The same has been done in Cardiff University. They're integrating the receiver. At the same time, we've got a lot of work going on site right now in terms of putting the infrastructure that we need in place for our two telescopes. So this is things like putting, you know, foundations in the ground, putting the ground, erecting these big ground screens that surround the telescope to protect the ground against ground pickup, and putting in, you know, electrical connections and internet connections, etc., making sure all of that stuff is in place for when we ship out the receivers. We've got a big milestone coming up in November, which is when our two telescope platforms, or the actual telescope mounts that sort of drive the telescope, they are being installed in November, December of this year. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for that. Once we have deployed, then with Simons Observatory, with the small aperture telescopes that are already observing, we are already collecting and analysing the data and have started this search for the B-mode signal, right? So that activity is ongoing. There's multiple people in this building that are working on that feverishly to try and tease out the signal and put constraints on that B-mode strength. And so I'm very excited to see what comes out of that. It's fascinating to be part of a project that, you know, where one is involved all the way from, you know, the building of the instrument through the deployment, through the collection of the observations, and through the analysis and scientific interpretation at the end as well. And so, you know, things are moving very fast, actually. In a couple of years' time, I think we will already have, fingers crossed, world-leading constraints on this strength of this B-mode polarization signal. So that's what excites me about the project.
That's really fascinating to hear about the work specifically with the CMB and what we can learn about the early universe. Over the last few years, there have also been a whole range of other telescopes and observatories going online. Euclid, for example, James Webb Space Telescope, Vera Rubin Observatory, which is another observatory that's going to be based in the Atacama Desert. What is the scope of combining measurements from the Simons Observatory and the CMB with all of these other instruments, and what could the future of astronomy look like when we combine all of this data?
This is a big area, actually, in terms of complementarity of CMB observations and other telescopes. So there is great excitement about combining Simons Observatory observations with survey observations from, for example, Euclid satellite and from the Vera Rubin Observatory as well. And so a lot of this stems from the fact that, you know, there's great interest in understanding dark energy and the evolution of the mass distribution in the universe across cosmic time. So if you can basically map how the distribution of matter has evolved across time, i.e. across redshift, then you can start to put constraints on things like dark energy, because dark energy suppresses, the more dark energy you have, it suppresses the growth of structure in the universe. And so by tracing out maps of, for example, the dark matter distribution in redshift bins or across cosmic time, then that will allow you to constrain those theories. So yeah, there's great excitement around combining Simons Observatory data with data from the LSST survey on the Vera Rubin telescope, and also with data from the Euclid surveys. And I know there's people in this room, Jonathan, that are working actively on those ideas. For example, and many people within the ESO collaboration and the Euclid collaboration, and I'm sure the LSST collaboration as well.
Well, thank you, Michael, so much for coming in. That sounds like there's so much happening, and it's going to be very soon get much better constraints and really unlock the early universe. So that's very exciting. Thank you for coming to talk to us today about this.
Oh, well, thanks for having us. Yeah.
Next, Jessie sits down with Dr. Katie Harrington from the University of Chicago on her work constructing the next generation of cosmological telescope facilities. She leads the integration and testing program for the Simons Observatory, combining her skills in instrumentation design and construction with data processing and pipelines.
Hi, I'm Jessie. Joining me today is Katie Harrington.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. How are you doing?
Pretty good. A little bit jet lagged, a little bit tired from all of this science talk, but it's been pretty fun.
And so, Katie, you've come to visit us in Manchester this week for a set of talks about the Simons Observatory.
Yeah, we call it our face-to-face meeting, which is our like yearly collaboration meeting where everybody comes together. We update ourselves on what we've been doing, how the telescopes are going, and look at all the new data analysis, start trying to work out what results we're going to be putting out in the next year, all those sorts of fun science.
Oh, very exciting. I hope that week goes well.
It's been going great so far. Very exciting.
Amazing. And so for the audience at home, what is the Simons Observatory?
Right. So the Simons Observatory is a millimeter wavelength observatory that is out in the Atacama Desert in Chile, where we put the telescopes out there because we like to observe from very high and dry deserts. It gives us the best view possible. This observatory, it was originally funded by the Simons Foundation for its first part of construction. Since then, the NSF has funded an extension to our larger telescope, and the SOUK, the UK people, and another group from Japan have contributed three more of our smaller telescopes. So we observe this light called the cosmic microwave background. This is the universe's baby picture. It is the earliest light that we can see of all time. And we are interested in doing this because it can tell us so much information about the universe. It can tell us things like what sort of matter or dark matter or neutrinos and stuff were inside of the early universe. So back then, the universe was a super hot and dense plasma. And that means that all of these like particle physics interactions that happen at really, really high energy get encoded into this light and then are, well, it gets encoded into the plasma first. And then as the universe expands, the universe cools down and the light is left to kind of stream towards us. And so we map this cosmic microwave background, both in temperature and what we call polarization. And this helps us kind of figure out the properties of the universe back then. Also, since it's been around for so long, it's been affected by the structure of the universe since then. So we can also see galaxies and galaxy clusters starting to form in the universe through how the light gets deflected by the large-scale structure. So huge amounts of information we can get. We have two different types of telescopes. We have a large telescope we call the Large Aperture Telescope, which is the LAT. This guy is 6 meters in diameter. It looks like a three-story apartment building that spins around out in the middle of the desert. It's quite fun. You can see it from the mountain on the road up for like an hour or so before you get to the site. It's pretty cool. And this is making high-resolution measurements. Things like looking at galaxy clusters, looking for tracers of, say, ineffective. So that is the number of relativistic particles that existed in the early universe. It also tracks lensing, so how the universe has deflected the light since early times, telling us how much structure is in the galaxy. The other types of telescopes we have are called the small aperture telescopes, the SATs. These are not small. They're like order of the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. So they're not small, but they are small relative to that three-story apartment building of a telescope. And these guys are mapping, they're looking for a very specific signal, which is called the primordial gravitational wave B-modes. This is a signal that would tell us if there was a period of inflation in the early universe, so a period of time where the universe expanded crazy, crazy exponentially. That helps with, it helps explain many features of our current standard model of cosmology. So we're really interested in seeing this signal and seeing if this happened. It also would tell us a lot of fun stuff about the highest energy particles in the whole universe if we were to see it. So that's, the SATs are really aimed towards mapping that B-mode signal.
So it sounds like quite an extensive challenge when it comes to, well, the amount of science that you guys want to do, but also the technical difficulties. And so I know that you've been working on cosmic microwave background instrumentation ever since your PhD. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could kind of tell us about what your role in this great journey is in a bit more detail.
Right, right. Okay. So I did my PhD at Johns Hopkins University, and I was working on a different experiment. This one was called CLASS, the Cosmology Large Angular Scale Surveyor. They're right next door to Simons Observatory now, so going back to the site was also kind of going back to see them, and that was really nice. They are also searching for this B-mode inflationary wave signal with a very different type of observing strategy than SO. And while I was in grad school, I built our polarization modulators, which is a device we put in the front of our telescope to try to make really clean measurements of the polarization. It helps like reduce the effects of the atmosphere and of the telescope as the data comes in. It like cleans it effectively if you build it and if it works right. And so that's been working really great. They've been observing since 2016. And they've recently actually put out a really fun result where they found the large angular scale E-mode signature, which is a specific polarization signature, which from the ground, and we were not sure we could do this. So that's pretty exciting. Then starting on Simons Observatory, I guess I joined SO 7 years ago or so now. I started when we were getting some of the first pieces of the hardware coming into labs in the United States. So we had had these three small aperture telescopes and the large aperture telescope, and we built all the cameras for those in the United States across multiple different universities. And I started at the University of Michigan, and then at the University of Chicago, we built a cryostat that we used to like test the optics for the large aperture telescope before it went out. We were making sure the camera would work as well as we wanted it to. The camera for the large aperture telescope is 2 meters in diameter, so it is also the size of a small car. The large aperture telescope receiver cools down something like 60,000 detectors total by the time it will be completely full, which should be somewhere, you know, in the next year or two. And so we couldn't cool them all down and test them in the camera themselves because it would just have taken too long. So we built this tester setup. And we wanted to make sure that the like efficiency of the whole optics plus the detectors would be like what we needed it to do to make the measurement that we wanted, and that the optics were going to be clean enough. In particular, we were really worried about, often it's called stray light, would be would cause problems in our measurements. We were trying to make sure that the optics design that told us we had fixed it had actually fixed it. And we think we proved that, so that was exciting. And so a whole bunch of just like testing of the hardware before it goes out. Since then, let's see, I've spent a decent amount of time working on planning the commissioning observations for all of the telescopes. So this is, you get the telescope on site, a whole bunch of people from anywhere who are building the cameras, they come down, they put it all together, plug everything in, and we want to make sure that it actually works on sky. So we worked out how we would originally use planets, like planet observations, to check and make sure that the telescopes were as efficient as we needed them to be, and that their beams looked good, so no large side lobes, no weird features that would cause problems with the cosmology measurements. So we made all of these measurements, looked at the noise levels in the detectors, made sure they were in the range that we wanted, and all the sort of like initial calibration features. That is wrapping up or wrapped up, depending on which telescope we're talking about here, because there's 4 of them so far, with 3 more coming. And so we're starting now to work on what is our next step towards science. We have like the general big plan, and now we're like working on implementing this plan of like how many calibration measurements do we need to do? Let's make sure we get our science measurements and that we observe the sky exactly how we'd plan to, all of this sorts of stuff. So that all like is coming down the pipe now in the next year, couple months, somewhere around there. Somewhere in the middle of all of that, I moved to Argonne National Lab. This is a Department of Energy lab that is actually right outside of UChicago. And that's where I work now, doing both this, and we were doing prep for CMB Stage 4, which is another future CMB experiment.
And so it sounds like quite a collaborative effort.
Yes.
Do you have an idea of roughly how many people are involved?
I can tell you that SO as a whole has nearly 400 researchers spanning across 60 member institutions right now, if I'm remembering the most recent numbers. Of that, I would say easily 50 to 60 have directly contributed to the hardware and measurements that we are doing now. And I'm probably underestimating that number because I can't even count the number of people who have helped build the software, help just set up the site, right? We are putting these telescopes on the top of mountains. There's nothing there in terms of infrastructure. We have our own diesel generators up there to run power, and we have people who work on SO to just help us keep all of that infrastructure together. So everyone from that down to all of the grad students making individual measurements, trying to make sure that everything will like work the way we want it to build the new technologies we need to make this work well, all of these sorts of things.
That's really awesome. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that we need to cool the detectors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so could you just explain why they need to be cooled down?
Right. To cool these detectors. So to make really detailed measurements in the millimeter wavelengths, one of the best technologies we have available are these detectors we call transition edge sensors. And the way that I shorthand how they work is that we play games with superconductivity. And by playing with that, we get the most sensitive thermometers ever. They are limited only by the quantum fluctuations of the photons that hit them. That is our noise limit, and that is also very exciting. How this works is we take this material that, when it is cooled down below 100 millikelvin, 0.1 degrees above absolute zero, that is where we operate our focal planes. That's how cold they are. Humans don't have an intuition for how things work there. You have to like just kind of work through the math and learning how the material properties works because we're not used to it in real life. But we cool them down that cold, and there's a transition where the material in the detectors goes between superconducting and normal, which is like a normal, if anyone's familiar with V equals IR, so you've got Ohm's law, that is normal resistance setups. And then in superconducting, the resistance is zero. But there's a really small transition range where, depending on the amount of power that hits the detector, the resistance changes by a lot. And so this gives us a really sensitive measurement if we put the device right on this transition, and then we let photons from the sky hit it, then the amount of photons hitting it will cause a really big reaction in its resistance. So we measure its resistance, and that tells us the power of the photons that hit the detector. And like I said, the noise in these things have been so well engineered by NIST. They've done the detector wafers, and then they were packaged at Princeton and then sent out to all of the different labs for testing and such, and then before we sent them down to the field. They're pretty cool. We have, right now on site, we have almost 60,000 TES detectors spread out across all of our different telescopes. And in the next few years, we'll have another 30,000 coming down for the Large Aperture Telescope. And then some more coming for the Japan Small Aperture Telescope, which will have fewer detectors for that telescope because it's a low frequency telescope and we can't fit as many detectors in there as possible. The SOUK sats, so the small aperture telescopes coming from the UK consortium, are actually a different technology called MKIDS, which will be new and exciting to see getting these on Sakai. They are much easier to read out, but kind of harder to build. So we'll see how it goes.
And so I guess this leads on perfectly to my next question, mm-hmm. which was, what are some of the most difficult technical challenges that the team has had to get around so far?
Oh, wow. So many. I think one of the ones which we have now surpassed, which was quite difficult for the whole team, was just working out how to make our detector wafers and how to package our detector wafers to get the readout requirements that we need. So I've been saying all of these numbers about how many detectors we have, this 30,000 detectors, 60,000 detectors, these sorts of things. These are not CCD cameras. They, you can't just take a single wire and plug it in. Instead, you have to like make these nice custom sets of like readout hardware. And sometimes, like some of the original ones that were deployed, say 10, 15 years ago, they could only read out like 16 detectors at once or 64 detectors at once. And so you had all of this like work and difficulty to get down to just like 64 detectors. We couldn't use that for Simons Observatory. You can't like take a whole readout box that's like, you know, say shoebox size and that can only read out 64 detectors if you need to get to tens of thousands. So we are using a new technology called microwave multiplexing with these Smurf electronics that were built at SLAC. And this involves using microwave resonators to track how much power is hitting our TES detectors. And that is quite fun. And the hardest part about, or one of the hardest parts, was actually connecting up all of the different detector wafers and such to get really nice resonators and really nice signals that then the Smurf electronics could actually track and read out well. And this was like very important for actually making sure that we could get our setup going, which reads out 1,000 detectors, which is much bigger than 64. It's obviously not as big as we would like, right? Like, we would love to have the CCD effect where you could read out a billion detectors with two wires. And I'm sure there's plenty of folks who would love to work to get to this setup. But getting even just the 1000x multiplexing was a really big deal and took a whole bunch of effort across many institutions to get that working. One of the other really big difficulties we've had is just the sheer amount of like coordination and infrastructure to get these telescopes out there. There's 100-ish people, 60-100-ish people continuously working for the last 5 years to get things together, and coordinating that and putting that all together has been a very fun challenge, but definitely not the easiest.
And so I know that the telescope has recently had its first light,
mm-hmm.
which, congratulations.
Thank you.
Must feel like an amazing achievement.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I guess, what is the status of the Simons Observatory right now? Mm-hmm. And do you have a rough timeline you might be able to give us for when the first round of proposals might start coming through?
Oh, what's funny is we don't actually have a proposal system. Mm. We are a survey instrument. So we have plans for surveys to do measurements, but we won't actually, how you would propose to get like quote unquote time on our system to try to get our data and stuff is actually to try to join our collaboration and to work with us to like design the surveys to make sure that the data that we're taking would be useful for the different science cases. But the status of Simons Observatory is, let's see, the Large Aperture Telescope did just get first light. We got first light back in February of this year, which was very exciting. The team there worked very hard to get it up there after the mirrors were installed because the weather there was pretty rough. But we were able to, I think the first map was a map of either Mars or Cine, which is a source near our galaxy center. So that was the first light for the LAT. The first light for our first sat that got on Sky was in October of 2023. So we've had several sats running for over a year now, and that's also been pretty fun. The timeline that most folks will ask us about is when are our first sets of results coming out? So when are our first cosmology results there? I definitely can't tell you a timeline for that one at this point. We're working, I would say, on our first round of like early papers. So this is the commissioning of results, how well the instrument is performing noise-wise, making sure that our maps like look about right and that we're not like seeing any big showstoppers. We're working on writing up a lot of this sort of work. And then we're going to be moving on to looking at towards the cosmological results and that sort of things. Those analyses can be quite difficult. There's always systematic effects and things that show up that you didn't expect, and you have to make sure that you have checked everything and passed all your null tests so that before you actually come out and put out those results. We would, of course, love for those to be very quick in the next couple of years, but I definitely can't give you a timeline for that.
As an astronomer who works in the Milky Way,
mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if there's any sort of science that can be done with Simons Observatory that's not related to cosmology and that's maybe more related to like galaxy formation or even in the Milky Way.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a whole galactic science working group. So both for the Large Aperture Telescope in particular is the one where we will scan every bit of the sky that we possibly can. So from Chile, that lets us map something between 60 and 70% of the sky. And a large fraction of that is the Milky Way. And we're going to be scanning it in six different colors. So six different frequency bands between 30 gigahertz and 280 gigahertz. And one of the things that I know we can get from there are maps of the magnetic fields in the galaxy. We can see this through how the light is polarized in the galactic center. We'll measure that very well. We can see thermal dust in the galaxy. We can see magnetic fields through synchrotron emission. We can see asteroids. So a little bit closer than the Milky Way, but we can see asteroids and like a whole bunch of other different effects closer in. I would actually even point you to, there are several papers by the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which we'll call it a precursor to Simons Observatory, that did a huge amount of galactic science studies, and they have some really fun papers showing the like how the polarization changes around the galactic plane and such. There's science for everybody in the millimeter wavelengths.
Fantastic. That's great news for me. You mentioned mirrors,
mm-hmm.
and generally when people think of millimeter astronomy, they think of big radio dishes. And so how do those mirrors differ from, well, the standard visual light mirrors and also from the classic kind of chicken wire that we
Right. So millimeter waves can span a pretty big gamut. But for our setup, we're talking 10 millimeters out to 1 millimeter or so. And that's the 1 to 10 millimeter range is like the good ballpark there. And, you could use a chicken wire for some of the 10 millimeter stuff, but once you start getting out to like a millimeter wavelength, you can't really use wire meshes or anything because, they're too small. The wire mesh would have to be too good. On the other hand, you can basically just use straight aluminum. So the Large Aperture Telescope has two mirrors, primary and secondary, and they are just very nicely polished aluminum. They're what we call segmented. So 6 meters, you can't actually get a single piece of aluminum that big without like a whole bunch of work that we couldn't get a 6 meter dish. We tried. But so they're segmented. So they're built in pieces. And we have this like whole crazy backup structure that all of the different pieces are put onto. And the team actually went out and had to help align all of these mirror panels with the help of the manufacturer, which was, this was made by Vertex, which was a company in Germany. And I learned recently, actually, this was crazy, to do this alignment, every single one of the alignment bolts on the back has a QR code. And they would go out, they would use laser trackers and photogrammetry measurements to figure out where all of the panels were. And when they, like, they put all the panels on this backup structure, and then they figured out where they all were. They did a whole bunch of math for how each of the panels needed to move. They had a programmable drill that could read the QR code, know how far it was supposed to screw the bolts in, and then they could just, like, do it, and it would only go that far. And that is insane to me. Because that's part of how they aligned these mirrors, well down beyond our requirements, which was pretty awesome. But the polished aluminum will make it really nice up out to the 1 millimeters. We could have used the big radio dishes and such are often not quite as polished, but they can be. Alma actually uses general radio dishes, and they go up to 800 gigahertz or so, which is well into the sub-millimeter wavelengths. I would say the differences between, say, using a dish and using a mirrors is a little bit of terminology and also just a little bit of, like, the type of telescope design. So our optical design for our telescope really does look like mirror, focus into a camera, just the way that the mirrors are shaped and that sort of thing. Whereas often with the dishes, it is, the dish acts like a big primary and it gets focused into, like, straight into the camera. So there's, like, maybe it's just also the vibes of how we, like, interact with our optics design, which just depends on, changes how we call them.
So that's some very interesting new technologies and techniques I had never heard of before used in the development of this telescope. No doubt, unfathomable amount of work from everybody involved. And so I guess my last question is, what kind of science are you most looking forward to being done on this telescope?
Oh, man. What is my favorite science? I will still go back to this inflationary science measurement, where the period of inflation that we are searching for here is the linchpin in modern cosmological theory. We can't really explain the expansion of the universe and how our universe looks today without some inflationary period that happens, like, you know, fractions of a second after, you know, whatever t equals zero was. And I'm really interested in seeing if we can get to that, if we can see this signal, see evidence of it, measure the energy scales that it could have happened. This will tell us a lot about the fundamental physics of the universe if we can see it. And so that's this primordial gravitational wave measurement is how we get down to this inflationary period. And I think that was what originally got me into cosmology, and it's still one of the things I'm very, very excited about. Although I will say that it's kind of like trying to have to pick your favorite child. I love working with the technology, and I love the day-to-day challenges of trying to make these measurements, and all of the science is all really cool that comes out of it. So I love just, like, also making the science happen.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Finally, we spoke with a range of Simons Observatory collaborators over lunch at the meeting and take a whistle-stop tour on what it really takes and who is involved when you build a telescope.
Hi, so could you first introduce yourself and where you came from?
Oh yeah, so I'm Alex Van Engelen. I'm a faculty member at Arizona State University, which is in the Phoenix area, out in the desert in Arizona.
Awesome, well, welcome to Manchester.
Yes, thanks, it's great to be here.
What is your relation to the Simons Observatory?
Right, so I'm one of the many scientists that we have in this big collaboration. My particular role is on the science and analysis side and the interpretation of the data. So we have colleagues who build the telescope, and then we have colleagues who take the raw data. My job is really to work with the data in the later stages and then compare them to our models of what's happening in the universe.
Awesome, and so what's the specific science case that you're particularly interested in?
Quite a few science cases. I have a group out in Arizona, and people are doing different things, but it's all related to learning how the universe evolves over time and how the structures form in the universe over time, and thinking about how we can learn these things from the new exciting data that we're getting from this telescope.
Awesome. And so, in your perspective, what makes the Simons Observatory so special?
It's a bringing together of so many different talented people. This is, we often say, you know, one person could never do this. You need so much different expertise, and bringing them all together also in a meeting like this when everyone can get face to face is really nice.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've learned that you didn't know before from this meeting?
Right. Well, we're just starting to take the data now, and the early data looks very promising. It's going to be really, really great. It's already performing really well compared to older data sets we have, or it's on the process towards performing that well. And so we're at very still early stages about learning a new science from Symes Observatory. But it's great to see that it's coming along so well. Things for the most part are looking very good. And so the types of things that I work on, kind of the later stages of the analysis, these things, you know, we're ramping them up and we're all ready to get going and start running our analysis on them very soon.
Yeah. That's really exciting. Yeah, really, really exciting.
It is.
And so could you just go a bit more detail about what you're currently researching?
So we're looking at how the light evolves and changes over time. So one thing that happens to it, this microwave light from the cosmic microwave background, it gets shifted and deflected through all the dark matter in the universe. This is gravitational lensing. And I'm one of the members of the group that measures this gravitational lensing effect. And it teaches us about the distribution of dark matter in the universe, all throughout the universe. Symes Observatory is going to do a terrific job at measuring this. And so our group at ASU, Arizona State University, is part of that team that measures this effect. And Symes Observatory is going to do a terrific job at this.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for the chat.
Yeah, thanks so much.
My name is Adam Hinks. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. Symes Observatory is pretty central to my research. I'm a cosmologist. I work with cosmic microwave background. I've been doing that for more than 20 years now. And the Symes Observatory is going to be perhaps the best source of information about the microwave background for the next decade. So I'm really thrilled to be part of it.
And so you said you were working on the CMB. Could you give us a bit more detail on what your research like entails?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are maybe three parts to my research. I contribute to the project, so I work a lot on software. An observatory like the Symes Observatory has a huge amount of hardware. That's what you see. What you don't see is all of the software that we need to write, a lot of it from scratch, to operate the whole thing, to collect the data, to process the data, to turn our raw bits and bytes into beautiful maps of the sky. And so my group contributes to that effort of writing software so that we can actually do things with the telescope. I'm also interested in large-scale structure. So one thing the microwave background does is it acts like a backlight to the clusters of galaxies and what we call the cosmic web, the largest scale structures in the universe. And using the CMB as a backlight, you can figure out what our universe looks like on those larger scales. So I'm interested in doing that. It's using the Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect. That's the fancy name for the technique we use. And then finally, I'm a cosmologist, but the Symes Observatory is going to be a fantastic instrument for what we call time domain astronomy. The microwave background itself is just sitting there. It's going to look the same in a year and in 10 years and 100 years as it looks today. But there are other things that are changing on much shorter time scales. You have stellar flares. You have the black holes in the middle of galaxies that are producing these jets that are wobbling around and making highly time variable signals. We hope to find explosions in distant galaxies. And the Symes Observatory is going to be really good at exploring that sector of the millimeter sky. And so I'm very involved in that effort as well.
What specifically about Symes Observatory makes it kind of stand out as a new instrument, as a new technique compared to the other telescopes that already exist?
Yeah, I would say it's sensitive. So it's got more than 10 times the number of detectors, pixels basically on the sky, than the Atacama Cosmology Telescope did, which was the previous observatory that I worked on at the same site in Chile. So you're able to take more sensitive pictures more quickly, and that's a big advantage. You can see deeper and deeper and deeper into the signal. And also, and this is kind of unique, it's a wide area survey. So we'll be observing about 60% of the total celestial sphere. And really, nobody has done that for these wavelengths, combining the sensitivity with the wide area. So for example, I mentioned those galaxies that are highly variable. We'll be able to see about 100,000 of these active galaxies. And that's thanks to the sensitivity and the fact that we're looking at such a wide area of the sky.
And so we've heard a lot about the technical difficulties that come with making such a difficult, such a such an intricate instrument. But I was just wondering if you could maybe talk to us more about the software, which is what you're working on, and how do we deal with making sense out of the, 60,000, 70,000 detectors that are inside of the camera?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, just keeping track of everything, right? So you need to package up your data. You need to save it in a format, in a file format that's useful for the analysis that happens later. You need to figure out how to transport those data from Chile to California and New Jersey and the United Kingdom efficiently. And then what I'm kind of involved in through the group that I lead is how do you kind of automatically process the data as it comes in every day? Can we make, and we're planning on doing this, we want to make maps every day of what we've seen so that right away we can see if the instrument's working well, if we're getting the same coverage of the sky that we're planning to do. Are all of our detectors working the way they're supposed to work? So we need to write all the software that gives us those reports, that processes those data. And we need to do that at almost real time. I mean, we're a few hours behind, but your scripts can't run more slowly than you're taking the data, or you'll get behind. So that also means writing good and efficient code.
So that's amazing to hear about the kind of how difficult the technical challenge is behind the scenes. Let's maybe finish off by asking you, what's the best thing that you've learned from this meeting since you've been here? And is there anything else you'd like to share about maybe your journey in astronomy with all of our listeners?
I think what I've really appreciated about this meeting is just meeting new people. I'm the chair of the membership panel. So we're the panel that accepts applications from potential new members and so on. So I kind of see a lot of names come across my desk of people that want to join, but I'm meeting some of them for the first time. And now we're about 350 people in the collaboration, and I haven't met a lot of them. So it's been nice meeting them and getting to know them and seeing the amazing work that they're doing.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for talking to us. And hopefully the rest of the meeting goes well, and best of luck getting the observatory up and running.
Delighted to talk to you.
My name is Dante Jones, and I am affiliated with University of Colorado Boulder, and I work at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. And yeah, I've been involved with the Simons Observatory project at NIST for 3 years now, and before that I spent a year at Princeton as well.
Awesome. So how does the Simons Observatory relate to the work that you do and the research that you enjoy?
Yeah. So at NIST, we have a microfabrication facility where we make the detector wafers, the routing wafers, and the multiplexing wafers for Simons Observatory. So we work on the eyeballs of the telescope and help turn light into visible data or readable data.
So completely unrelated to the Simons Observatory, but working at NIST, did you ever get the chance to look at some of the standard measurement units, so like the standard kilogram and the standard meter, etc.?
Yeah. Right down the hall from me is the atomic clock, where they have they keep the time. So yeah, the keepers of the time are right down the hall from me.
That is so cool. And so going back to the Simons Observatory.
Yeah, of course.
We've heard so much about the difficulties surrounding making the detectors, mm-hmm. and I think it's 70,000 detectors for each.
Yeah. There's 68,000 individual detectors that comprise the SO nominal. So the first round of telescopes that are out there. So the three small aperture telescopes, mm-hmm. and the large aperture telescope, and that kind of segues a bit into my role specifically. Like my main task is I do the quality control on the multiplexing wafers. And so if you don't know what microwave multiplexing is, it's basically a technique that allows numerous microwave signals to all be read out on one single line. And so if you can imagine 68,000 detectors all need to be read out. And so if we were to do direct cabling, that would require 18,000 cables to be plugged in. And there's just not enough space, and like the wire management would be a mess. So we employ multiplexing instead. So in any one given detector wafer, there are 28 multiplexing chips. And the multiplexing chips are like 4 millimeters by 20 millimeters. And each one of them can read out 66 channels. And so we're able to read out about 1,700 channels per detector wafer using just 28 of these little tiny chips.
And so without getting into the weeds, because I know we don't have diagrams or anything to explain properly, but like how is it possible to read 68 different channels all at once?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's where the multiplexing comes in. And part of it is taking advantage of the superconducting properties. And so when you have low resistance in along a line, you can send more signals through it. We can send very small signals through it without like overwhelming it. And so we have transition edge sensors that are inductively coupled to the detectors, and those transition edge sensors are also inductively coupled to gigahertz resonators, and so we're able to put them all on one line. And so we can send all of the signals through the single chip and then read it all out.
What is the best thing that you've learned from this meeting, or your favorite talk?
Favorite talk? Kind of hard. I don't know if I can pick just one. I will say it's really exciting for me as someone who's just sort of had their head in instrumentation for this whole time. You know, when I was coming to the face-to-face, like in San Diego a few years ago, you know, the telescopes hadn't been deployed yet, and so everyone was focused on hardware. And now the main focus is the data analysis. And so seeing all of this come to fruition is incredible. And I learned so much. As yeah, I'm really focused on the hardware side, and I've never, you know, read out any of this data and like learning all these new techniques. And there's just so much information coming out, and there's so many different things that we can do with the data. I think that's really special. And seeing all of these bright scientists around the world coming together to do the same thing is just really inspiring. And yeah, every time I come to these, I just get a fresh sense of inspiration.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time. Do you have anything you would like to add just to close off?
I'd like to give a shout out to Casey Wagner. Not only is he a great scientist, but he works tirelessly to do a lot of the stuff behind the scenes to make everything run. Yeah.
I'm Dan Meerburg, and I'm a cosmologist from the Netherlands. So I was born in Amsterdam, and I'm currently a professor at the University of Groningen in the north of the Netherlands. I've been involved in CMB science for basically at the end of my PhD in 2011, and have been involved in Simons since 2016, so basically from the start. So I've been part of the analysis working groups. I've been involved mostly in what's called the lensing bispectrum working group. And in that working group, we focus on two things, namely lensing and the bispectrum. Okay, then you might wonder, what is the bispectrum? And that is concerned with trying to analyze the CMB data to look for signatures from the very early universe. So effectively right after the Big Bang, the fact that you see these small variations in temperature in this background, the distribution of these fluctuations is sourced by what we now think is cosmological inflation, which is a very brief period of exponential expansion. And one way to entangle different models of that early universe is by looking at the statistics of these fluctuations. And the bispectrum is basically a summary, what we call a summary statistic. Most of the time we look at the power spectrum, and that is the variance of these fluctuations in the background. But you can also look at higher order statistics. So then you look at what we call non-Gaussianities, and these can be best measured with the bispectrum.
What do you think is the kind of selling point of the Simons Observatory? But also, is there any challenges that you think the observatory still has to overcome?
Well, I think the biggest selling point is that historically the CMB community has been kind of a community by itself, where the main goal was to try and understand cosmology and effectively constrain just a handful of numbers. But I think what is different now is that we're learning that the CMB is not only a source of, you know, understanding cosmology and everything that happened before the CMB was formed, but it's also this backlight, right? So it allows us to infer from the measurement of the CMB also stuff that happened in between the moment the CMB was formed and what we observe today. And so that's why it's sometimes called a backlight as well. And I think that opens up many, many possibilities, and that I think has made the field much broader than it used to be. And I think what's unique about the Simons Observatory is that it has this high cadence, which means that you can observe the sky, the entire sky, in a relatively short period, while the experiments before that, they could do that, but we can do that now with very high signal-to-noise, relatively, because the instrument is so good. Your second question regarded any challenges. Well, I think that you're always pushing the boundary. So I think that you always hit a point where everything is new. You build like a new instrument. It has all kinds of new things that you didn't think about, right? Unforeseen issues. So it's a matter of adaptation.
It must be really rewarding for you to have been there since the beginning and seen it evolve to the scale that it is now. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was lovely.
So my name is David Alonso. I work at the University of Oxford. I'm originally from Spain, so if you want to pronounce my name the way I would pronounce it, is David. Well, I'm a cosmologist, so I work in different experiments. I'm kind of in the interface between theory and data analysis and observations and things like that. I work in the Simons Observatory, so that's about 50% of my time I spend thinking about Simons Observatory. In particular, one of the things that I'm really excited about in Simons is B-modes. There's many, many reasons why SIMONS, I think, it's exciting. One of the maybe most exciting ones, especially for the broader communities, the small aperture telescopes in ESO. So small aperture telescopes are the telescopes that are most sensitive to the largest scale polarized cosmic microwave background fluctuations. And why is that interesting? We know that there's a particular form of polarization that we call B-mode. So this is for those who understand parity, for example, in physics, it's the parity odd component of the polarization. So it's a particular mode of polarization in the photons of the CMB. And the reason why that's really interesting is that we know that the only way we could have B-modes in the CMB is if they were generated by gravitational waves generated in the early universe. So this could be, you know, the Big Bang inflation should have generated some level of gravitational waves. And this is the potentially most sensitive way we have of actually detecting them through this. So that's why it's interesting. That's the part that I'm most excited about.
So what is the best thing that you've learned this week at this meeting?
So this is an extremely exciting time for the SIMONS Observatory because we have about 1 year of data basically from the SATs and from the other part of the SIMONS Observatory, which is the Large Aperture Telescope. So now we have a few months of data from that. So this is the first meeting where we're actually seeing data from the two sets of telescopes. And not only that, but people are super quickly starting to get results out of them. So it's been super exciting to see all these kind of new results from new data. And an extremely scary part of this is that we're seeing how, because we have so many detectors in SIMONS Observatory compared to previous experiments, we can actually get levels of sensitivity that before would have taken us many, many months or many, many years. We can get them in a matter of a few weeks. Maybe I can talk a little bit about the other reason that I'm quite excited about ESO, I guess, which is how, if you combine it with other very exciting experiment that the UK is also involved in. So things that are targeting not so much the cosmic microwave background, but, you know, low redshift things, galaxy structure formation. So I'm talking about experiments like the Rubin Observatory, for example, or Euclid. There's actually a lot of information that CMB observatories like ESO have that when you analyze it in combination with these other low redshift datasets, they, you know, there's many new things that you can explore that way, right? So I'm really interested in, for example, cross-correlating SIMONS Observatory maps basically with large-scale structure observables from LSST and Rubin Observatory, etc. And it will allow us to basically answer a lot of questions about both cosmology and astrophysics that we don't know that much about, basically. So, and that's another thing that I'm quite excited about.
It's exciting to see how one big collaboration, which is big enough, but how it plays into other collaborations.
Yes, that's right. And the dynamics of trying to work with everyone actually is kind of interesting, because it used to be that there was a lot of competition, I think, between different experiments and things like that. And I think we're reaching the point where, you know, a lot of the community is actually involved in many of these experiments at the same time. So you can't really compete when you're actually a part of all these collaborations, right? So I think the community is becoming a lot more collaborative now than it used to be, and that's kind of nice to see.
My name is Ellie Shaw. I'm a postdoc at the University of Texas at Austin, and I primarily work on the pointing models for the telescopes for the observatory, trying to make sure that the telescopes are pointing where we actually want them to go.
That sounds really awesome, but also really complicated.
Of course, there's the motors on the platforms themselves that have the electronics to read out where they think that they're pointing, but they're not always calibrated perfectly. And there can be other structural things that happen with gravity, or if they're not sitting perfectly flat, that you can end up pointing slightly off of where you think you are. And then when that turns out in the data, looking at a map, it can be smeared, or you could be looking entirely the wrong spot.
I'm kind of interested in the idea that actually your telescope's probably not looking where you want it to be. Is this something, have you worked on this before, or is this kind of a new challenge that you found in your postdoc research?
It's definitely a new challenge. During my graduate research, I worked on SPIDER, which is a balloon-borne telescope that we launched out of Antarctica. That has its own pointing challenges because it's not even attached to the ground. It's tethered to a balloon. But I didn't work on the pointing for that. I just trusted the people that did. So this is definitely something I haven't done before, but I'm learning as I go.
And so it sounds like what you're doing is a mix of both hardware problems and software problems. Is there something that pops out of your head as like a great lesson that you've learned?
I would say something that I was surprised about was a lot of the math that we use for pointing. It's using a strange vector-like quantity called a quaternion, but it's also very commonly used in computer gaming, video gaming. So how your point of view of the character is pointing and moving around in the world is all this quaternion math. And so I'm sure there are a lot of video gamer coder people that know a lot more about this than I did when I started. So
that's kind of interesting. The two worlds collide. I like that. Is there something that you've learned from this meeting that has surprised you or most interested you?
It's always interesting to hear the other issues that people run into with their looking at certain systematics or things that they see in the data. And I can wonder, I wonder if the pointing, if we can keep improving it, if that will also improve what they're working on. So yeah.
It all kind of funnels down, I suppose, because you can't do exciting kind of like looking at exotic things or really unusual places in the sky if you have no idea that your telescope isn't looking at that.
Right. It's looking. And I should say we do correct for the pointing, but yeah, it is kind of fundamental to make sure that you get that as accurate as possible so that you can actually do the science that you want.
Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about where you're affiliated and what your job is?
I am Martina. I come from Italy. I'm based in Ferrara, which is a little town in between Padua and Bologna, if you know more or less where they are in Italy, northeastern part of Italy. I work in the field of CMB since my master's, basically, and I joined the Simons Observatory collaboration since the beginning of the collaboration, so almost 10 years ago, more or less. From then, I've been working on the high-level analysis part of the collaboration, theory curing, in particular the theory side, and my duties has been so far to collect all the different pieces of the analysis that is done by the different groups within the collaboration and gluing them together so that we can deliver the science results that we expect from the collaboration, talking about how the universe is formed, how the universe is evolving, what it contains, and how the different pieces of the universe interact with each other. My specific focus is on a very elusive component of the universe, which is neutrinos. Very tiny particles that we know very little about, apart from the fact that they are part of the matter that constitutes the universe.
That's fab. And with such a big collaboration, I suppose it's really important to be able to pull everyone together and pull these different groups. What do you think is going to be the biggest challenge with trying to glue everything all together?
I believe the biggest challenge is to find a common language that all the different branches can speak, because the collaboration, as you said, is very big, and so there are different aspects that are covered by different groups brilliantly, and the real challenge is try to connect all these different dots together in order to create a common ground where they can interact and interact more efficiently than they will do individually.
And you said that you're most interested in neutrinos. What can they tell us about the universe that we live in?
They will tell us a lot, because so far we know that these particles have a mass, because we observe some specific patterns that they have because they are massive, but we don't know exactly what the mass is, so what the mass scale is. And that is one of the biggest unknowns in the standard model of particle physics. And our expectation is that cosmology, which is one of the different ways in which we can learn about neutrinos, will be the first one to tell us how massive these particles are. And this will enable us to understand better the fundamental properties of these particles and how they fit within the standard model of particle physics. So they are a sort of window towards the very high energy of the fundamental theory models that describe how they behave and why they are around us. I think that I would just like to acknowledge the fact that we are also a very young collaboration, in a sense that there are so many junior folks that are devoting lots of their time and efforts towards this collaboration and delivering the results that we expect. And so a big cheer up to all the junior members that are part of the collaboration and without whom anything would be possible.
And hello, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do, where you're from?
Sure, yeah. My name is Toby Satterthwaite. I'm a third year PhD student out of Stanford University. I work here on the Simons Observatory on our readout electronics. So that's thinking a lot about how we actually get the data from our detectors. All of our detectors are super, super cold, 100 millikelvin, or, you know, minus 272 some, you know, degrees Celsius. And so it's really difficult to get all the information from them while maintaining these cryogenic conditions. So we have a novel system for doing this that we've deployed to the Simons Observatory. first time we've deployed something at this scale. So lots of problems come with that. So I try to work on figuring out a lot of these problems, improving the system, and getting it up and running for our data.
Brilliant. A completely different set of challenges to the astrophysics side, whereby you have a problem that you have to fix, otherwise you don't have a telescope. What is the best thing you've learned from this meeting? Is there something that stands out to you in terms of the research or the instrumentation?
Oh, I think more the former. I think, you know, we've been able to bring so many people together from so many different parts of the experiment. You know, I think a lot about the instrumentation right now, and I'm talking to, you know, a small group of instrumentationalists. But bringing so many people from all these different science cases here to one place and to try to learn from them has been really fascinating. There are a lot of really exciting applications for this data now that we're starting to get it.
And you're doing your PhD currently?
I am, yes.
How does working with the Simons Observatory fit into your PhD life? Has it affected it, or has it improved it? Or?
It's been the main focus of my PhD, so it's the whole thing of it, yeah. I would say, you know, a real advantage to it is that I spent a lot of time down in Chile, actually at the experiment, working on deploying the system. So a significant part of my PhD has been going back and forth from California to Chile. It's a long journey. It's about 30 hours door to door, three flights, many drives, but it's really exciting and it's really fun to be down there. It's an incredibly beautiful part of the world. It's certainly remote. It's, you know, very cold up there. It can be very windy, but I'd say worth it for the science that we can do.
The coolest part of being on site? Do you have like a standout moment?
Ooh, I would say probably some of the wildlife. Before I started going down there, I had no idea that flamingos were native to the Atacama Desert. I think, you know, as an American, you sort of think flamingos, you think Florida, these kinds of places. But to be sort of in the middle of nowhere, dry as you could imagine, and then all of a sudden stumble upon these little salt flats that are covered in flamingos is a pretty unbelievable experience.
That's incredible. I would not have guessed flamingos in the Atacama Desert.
Fine. Yeah. We also have these little things called vizcacha. So they are small animals that are sort of like a cross between a chipmunk and a bunny, and they only really live above 14,000 feet above sea level. And that's where we start to drive off the highway up towards our mountain. We're up at 17,000 feet, so from 14,000 to 17,000, we're pretty much driving off-road. And sometimes if you look carefully on the rocks, you can see these little things sunbathing there, just enjoying life. I don't think they have many natural predators. They just sit on rocks and just kind of enjoy the warmth all day long. Very cute.
Wildlife and radio antennas and astronomy. Fabulous.
On such a collaborative project requires collaboration. So we want to say thanks to our very own Jonathan Wong, a final year PhD student here at JBCA, who researched astrophysical probes in galaxy surveys to understand the CMB and dark energy. Also, big thanks to ESO Outreach, Casey Wagner and Eve Vavayakis. Casey is an assistant professor of physics at North Carolina State University. Casey is an assistant professor of physics at North Carolina State University, helping people within the collaboration to meet their scientific goals through governance, training, and outreach. Eve is an assistant professor of physics at Duke University, where she is focused on the pipeline development for galaxy groups and clusters, as well as field instrumentation work.
And now, on to the feedback.
Take Your Risk says, honestly, a new Jodcast episode is one of the things I look forward to at the start of every month. Sounds like some fun stuff in July's episode.
Naeem Khan says on Facebook, always amazing, always interesting, always thought-provoking.
Jed Mack writes on X, days of Ian Morrison, George Bendo, Tim O'Brien, Jen Gupta, recently out of hospital, and I am looking forward to getting back to listening again soon. So speedy recovery, Jed.
Oh, so interesting to hear my name called out in the comment. And Francois from Cape Town emails, hi, great to have you back. Would love to see even more content. Well, thank you for all of that feedback. And remember, if you want to get in touch, you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or send us post. Link and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net.
Thank you to the ESO collaboration for the interviews. The audio editors were Jamie Inslee, Tom Williams, and Jesse Marin. The show editor was Louisa Mason, and the producer was Lily Correa Magnus. Until next time,
Jod on.